The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article will be done in two parts. Part 1, Saving Our Sisters. Recognizing the signs of depression and suicide risk in a loved one can be critical. The first life-saving step is getting them the help they desperately need. Here is what you need to know. In June, the news that 39-year-old journalist-turned-successful TV writer Jazz Waters, a.k.a. Jazz Fly, had committed suicide sent shock waves of sadness throughout the black media and entertainment circles. What happened? Had anyone seen it coming? Just over a month later, word that singer Tamar Braxton had been hospitalized after a rumored suicide attempt sparked more feelings of despair in our community. That same week, comedian and actress Amanda Seales revealed that she'd suffered a nervous breakdown in March because, she says, the pressures of fame had become too great. Braxton survived, and Seales sought help through therapy. But as we see from Waters' tragic death, these stories don't always have a hopeful ending, which is why we can't afford to ignore black women when they are faced with a mental health crisis. Fonda Bryant almost wasn't here to tell her story. Her ongoing battle with depression and insecurity began in her early teens and plagued her throughout most of her adult life. As a daughter of an absent father, the late legendary blues singer Johnny Taylor, who, she says, had refused to acknowledge her as a child, Bryant struggled with low self-esteem and had difficulty forming healthy relationships with men. Taylor died without Bryant ever meeting him face to face. Then she endured an unthinkable tragedy while in high school. Pregnant at 16, Bryant gave birth to a daughter 3 months prematurely. The baby died in the hospital shortly after she was born, and Bryant was traumatized. Ignoring her depression 7 years later, she went on to welcome a son, whom she named Wesley. But the joys of motherhood could not lift her out of the emotional hole she had slowly and silently crept into. Bryant was around 29 years old the first time she attempted to take her own life. As a struggling young woman who was constantly at odds with her own mother, she felt overwhelmed and hopeless. One day, tired of arguing with her mother, Bryant swallowed a bunch of pills, aiming to end her pain for good. The drugs made her sleepy and weak. But then fear and panic kicked in. She called the paramedics, who arrived to help. Thankfully, she had not swallowed a fatal dose or combination of pills, but she had raised the first red flag. Bryant's mother took her to an outpatient facility to get help. By the late 1980s, she went to see a psychiatrist on her own. She arrived terrified and desperate for support, but ultimately left feeling even more alone. As a black woman, she recalls feeling a cultural disconnect between herself and the psychiatrist treating her. They ultimately released her without prescribing any medication or creating a long-term care plan, something that often happens to black people suffering from undiagnosed mental health illnesses due to systemic racism in healthcare. They didn't really give me any kind of help with what to do about my mental health, Bryant recalls. I was still out there on my own. One of the worst things you can do when you are dealing with a mental health condition that can lead to suicide is isolate yourself, because then those thoughts start getting louder If you don't know how to redirect them, they will turn into action. And that's exactly what happened. She tried her best to move forward, eventually even leaving Georgia to live and work in North Carolina. On February 14, 1995, Bryant, then 35, decided once again to end her life. She filled prescriptions of pain-relieving drugs, Flexeril and Anaprox, and took steps to ensure that Wesley, who was 12 at the time, would not be the one to find her lifeless body. She made her goodbye call to her Aunt Kelly. It turned out she was calling her angel. I don't remember much about the conversation, but I told her she could have my shoes, Bryant recalls. I don't remember what she said, but after we hung up, she called me back and asked me if I was going to kill myself, and I told her yes. Aunt Kelly took immediate action to try to save her niece, contacting the police and taking out a warrant to have her involuntarily committed on site. Bryant finally began to get real help for her depression, the kind that allowed her to arm herself with better skills to battle her anxieties. She's the first to admit that surviving was far from easy. Even as she entered her 50s, she periodically found herself battling thoughts of suicide. Her kind-hearted son, Wesley, is the person who helped her see the good in all that she has endured. He said, "What you are going through, I know you can help people who are going through the same thing," Bryant shares. "He just nicely gave me a little kick in the pants, and the light bulb went off that day." Bryant is now 59 years old, and her self-care toolbox consists of therapy when she needs it, exercise, and her volunteer work. She has become an influential and well-respected mental health and suicide prevention advocate based in Charlotte, where she serves on the local board for the National Alliance of Mental Illness. Bryant spends her time training others on how to recognize when someone has mental health issues and how to best help them cope. And who better to do that than someone who has attempted suicide 2 times? In addition to speaking about suicide around the country, Bryant recently spearheaded a campaign to put suicide prevention signs in Charlotte parking decks. She also launched her own nonprofit organization, Wellness Action Recovery, with a focus on mental wellness. Bryant is on a mission to help people recognize that we all can make a difference when it comes to being someone's lifeline and offering support when they need it most, in those moments when they are fighting to stay with us. The next article is titled, "What Denzel and Paleta Washington Did for Omari Hardwick That He'll Never Forget." Today, actor Omari Hardwick is a beloved actor booking back-to-back roles on screen, but like many stars, his beginnings were humble. The series finale of TV1's Uncensored explores Hardwick's rise to fame, and the power star opens up like never before about his days as a struggling actor, the audition that changed his life, and who in Hollywood lent him a helping hand when he needed it most. Hardwick, 46, reveals that Denzel and Paleta Washington embraced him early on after he met and connected with their son, fellow actor John David Washington. John David was like Omari, and I thought, wow. And so as I got closer and closer to him, Hardwick shares, revealing that it was John David's mom who instantly let him in. Paleta took to me very quickly. She initially told me, "I don't have another space in my home," or she might have said,
I don't have space in my mind to deal with another crazy Capricorn. She said it with laughter. And at that point, I knew that Denzel was a Capricorn. And so again, it was just a joke because she took me in like nobody's business. Hardwick, who's always been open about how close he is to his own mother, took to Pauletta too. She became my mom away from my mom, Hardwick continues. She became so much to me, so we got super close and I was broke. Hardwick admits that when times were tough, being a part of the Washington extended family was part of his support system. Pauletta and Denzel eventually let me couch in their house, Hardwick shares. Sometimes I would just be over there, just for peace and spirit. Pauletta had such an incredible spirit and energy, and John, David, and Kataya, Olivia and Malcolm, those are their twin kids, and so John, David, and I got super, super close and still are to this day. When Hardwick landed a role in Spike Lee's film Sucker Free City in 2004, things began to look up for him, and he couldn't wait to share with his second family. So during that time, I was all excited to go back to them with that news, Hardwick adds. You know, that Sucker Free was something that was going to make it where I didn't need to borrow money from them anymore. And I never really did, but they definitely gave me $1,500 when my car was about to be repoed. Hardwick is a bona fide Southern gentleman who grew up in Georgia, where he excelled at sports, acting, and spoken word. Today, he is a husband, a father, and one of Black Hollywood's leading men. Tune in to TV One to hear Hardwick tell the story of his upbringing and rise to stardom. Dive deep as he tells the story of his career thus far. The next article is titled Essence Times Pepsi HBCU Homecoming. See everything you missed from day two. An HBCU homecoming experience wouldn't be complete without a moment of praise to lift our spirits and soothe our souls. And that's exactly what happened on day two of Essence Times Pepsi HBCU homecoming celebration. An inspirational word from Sarah Jakes Roberts was just what we needed to get the day started. Before the stellar award-winning Jonathan McReynolds and the incredibly talented DOE blessed our ears with a magical acoustic performance. Taking things up a notch, our Divine Nine tribute paid the perfect homage our HBCU Greek brothers and sisters, which was the perfect segue to a mouth-watering cooking segment with actress, entrepreneur, Spelman graduate and proud member of Delta Sigma Theta, Miss Keisha Knight Pulliam. Up next, Mac Wilds and Baratunde Thurston joined us to share timely messages about making our voices heard at the polls this election season and our 2019 She Got Now honorees popped in to share a few words. Last but certainly not least, Jonathan McReynolds and DOE returned to serenade us yet again. Before we heard from a few alumni and Pepsi executive Annette Knuckle to close out the show. The next article is part two of Saving Our Sisters. For Black women in particular, there is strength in fellowship. Black women are more likely to seek support from their friends and family than from a mental health clinician, says Kamisha Spates, PhD, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Kent State University and co-author of The Study I've Got My Family and My Faith, Black Women and the Suicide Paradox. Now, think about the power in that, Spates continues. We are more likely than our white counterparts to go to a friend or family member. So that means when we start to talk about things like social stigma and the issues around mental illness or suicide in the Black community and among Black women, we really have a unique opportunity to equip other Black women and Black families and community members with information that could literally save a life. Too often, admission of struggling with mental health issues is seen as a weakness in our community. For some, admitting they need help takes away from the illusion of being a strong Black woman. According to a 2018 Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, with an estimated 1.4 million attempts, while men are 3.6 times more likely to die by suicide than women. Women are 1.4 times more likely to attempt suicide. It is true that the suicide rate among Black people is significantly lower than that for other races, but even one life is too many. We can't talk about suicide as just this overall general topic because the Black community is so very diverse, explains Spates, who says she has been studying Black women and suicide for more than 10 years. There are so many different subpopulations within the community that it is very difficult to speak about the issue of suicide using blanket terminology. And just as with so many other risks and diseases we face in this world, the needs of Black women are unique. Black women's cases, their experiences with suicide, some of the risk factors that appear to be present, and some of the approaches that appear to be more helpful for Black women may not necessarily be the case for other members of the Black community, Spates notes. Yes, our Black women's suicide rates are low, lower than other groups, but I think there are some areas where we could certainly raise awareness, because it is definitely happening. And the impact of the legacy of suicide is a whole other conversation after one occurs. But how do we know the right moment to step in? Put another way, how do we know when to overstep for the right reasons? How do we show up for our mothers, sisters, or other loved ones at a time when their well-being may be most at risk? When a loved one is slow to respond to text messages or to return a phone call, it is easy to assume they are just busy, like so many of us. But sudden behavioral changes like these can be a sign that trouble is brewing. Bryant recommends looking out for personality changes that seem out of character with someone's usual routine. They are withdrawing. They are not the same person, she says. Things that they found pleasure in, like going to the gym, taking yoga, or going out with their girlfriends, all of a sudden, they don't do that anymore. Speaking up during these times is crucial in getting them help. But how you reach out matters too. We have a tendency to ask people how they are doing instead of how they are feeling, and there's a difference between the two, explains Keisha Jen, a licensed clinical social worker and president of the Mecklenburg Mobile Crisis Team, a 24/7 crisis intervention program in Charlotte. If I ask how you're feeling, I am probably going to get more of what is authentically going on with you right now. If you are feeling sad, if you are feeling great, if you are feeling tired, I am going to get a more accurate picture of what is going on with you than if I just say, "How are you doing?" When it comes to Black women checking in on one another, it is critical that the conversations meet her where she is. Often a good starting point is the church. Given the number of Black women who make up our church congregations throughout the country, we need a combination of every strategy that could happen in the church, Spates insists. We need conversations, we need workshops, we need gateway or prevention-based training. She recommends that the focus of these ongoing conversations be grief of recovery, addiction, divorce, and those sorts of issues. If you identify someone in your life who may be having suicidal thoughts, knowing where to get help locally is also key. We can find any and everything online right now, and most counties and cities have mobile crisis teams, says Jen. Typically, they are 24/7, and there is an 800 number to call, and there is always the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255. That's an extremely important number. But first, we have to recognize the signs. As Bryant works hard to dismantle stigmas surrounding the mental health in Black communities, she believes what's most important to understand is that for those suffering, the journey will be a marathon, not a sprint. Every day that I wake up and every day that I make it through, it's a blessing, she admits, because I'm still not out of the woods. When I speak to students and others, I let people know it's a battle every day, but it is a battle I expect to win. The next article is called Agnes Gund, Art for Justice Founder, Walks the Walk in New Film Aggie. Inspired by Ava DuVernay's 13th, the philanthropist and art scion invested $100 million to start the Art for Justice Fund to combat white supremacy and structural racism, and she has no plans on stopping now. As the past president of the Museum of Modern Art, Agnes Gund left a legacy of inclusion that transformed the institution now known for its representation of artists from across the globe and women artists. And she was legendary as a patron and a woman who found the hyper monetization of art and the consequent walls it erected harmful. Artists are meant to be known and supported, their ideas shared and engaged. But 3 years ago, Aggie broke rank with herself and sold Masterpiece, a painting by her friend, the revered and late artist Roy Lichtenstein, for $165 million. She didn't do it, however, to enlarge her own coffers. Rather, as a grandmother of 12 children, 6 of whom are Black, and as a human being who could not stop hearing Eric Garner beg for breath, nor ignore the harsh truths of white supremacy and mass incarceration detailed in Ava DuVernay's Oscar-nominated film 13th, Aggie used the earnings from the sale and began the Art for Justice Fund at the Ford Foundation. I'm here and my mother is here not to be allies in a movement to end mass incarceration and ensure racial equity, but to be accomplices, Kat Gund. There were a lot of reasons I started Art for Justice, Aggie shares in a way that feels classically Midwestern, firm but not aggressive, clear and absent theatrics or vanity. I want Art for Justice, A4J, to be used to show people what else they can imagine, how else their minds can be opened, she begins before making her full stop statement. I was certainly inspired by Ava's film, and there was certainly a heartbreak I had about the world because there were so many Black people incarcerated and white people were getting away with it. But it is also true that I have children whom I love tremendously, and I do not want a world where they are treated as less than equal. Using a series of interviews, file footage, and private images, the film tells the story of a woman who changed the world of art, and then used art to change the world. And while the broad role that art has played in Aggie's life is a through line, among others, there are interviews with Thelma Golden, Elizabeth Alexander, Dorothy Lichtenstein, members of the Museum of Modern Art staff, and Ava DuVernay. That through line streams in red, black, and green. We are not 10 minutes in before Aggie visiting the artist Xavier Simmons as she creates a large-scale visual inspired by Jacob Lawrence's Migration series, says plainly, "I think there should be reparations." Removing layers of bureaucracy that often keeps support from those who are on the ground, executing powerful work, Art for Justice has supported Black women artists like Xavier, but also advocates like Susan Burton, founder of a New Way of Life Reentry Project, which provides home and healing support, safe houses for women coming from prison. "Aggie supported our network of 10 homes and saw me as a weaver," Burton tells Essence. "That's my art, and getting to know her allowed me to see art differently. I used to think it was just a luxury, but now I am able to interpret life and my own experiences by looking into paintings, my imagination, and the possibilities of what could be done, what I could do as a Black woman, in a racist, patriarchal society grew," says the woman, Michelle Alexander, who was called the Harriet Tubman of our time. "I was certainly inspired by Ava's film, and there was certainly a heartbreak I had about the world. In an unquiet year that will be soundtracked by cries and gasps, chants and prayers, demands for truth amid the corpiconia of lies, Aggie is a documentary, like its subject, enters quietly, without dramatics, and with the clarity born of deliberate observation. This is best summed in the film when the artist Fernandez, one of now 1 million children who has benefited from studio in the school, Aggie's New York City Public Schools program, shares that the importance of art, the urgency of the work, is that it allows us to look into the chaos and find the pattern. In this offering by a daughter and filmmaker, an advocate and artist, we look into the brutal chaos the American enterprise has had on Black life, and in doing so, we find those patterns of harm, but we also find patterns of hope. We find patterns of all that possibility that lays before us. We find patterns of all that possibility that lays before us if we are provided the space to heal, to vision, to imagine, to create, to breathe.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.